Hi everyone, I am back in the office today. I am off jet ski. It was fun last week. Apologies to the people who said they felt seasick watching me on the jet ski. Might have been a good example of where the podcast comes in useful there. Also, always look at the horizon. That's the other trick. All right, so things this week. First of all, big thing for me this week is I finished a Pluralsight course. Now, this is a full Pluralsight course. It is one of the traditional sort of voice over screencast things that I've been doing for so many years. I've done a lot of other play-by-play courses in recent times where there's me and someone else and we talk to each other. And I've got two of those in the can about to come out shortly as well. But the one about the full course that I just mentioned, that finally got wrapped up. And that's always a joyous occasion because there is just so much bloody work in doing one of these courses. So this course is what every developer must know about HTTPS, which is a very self-explanatory title. And if you've been watching enough of what I do in this particular medium, as well as on my blog and the Twitters and all this sort of thing, you'll have a bit of a sense of the sort of stuff that covers. But I thought I'd give you just a quick snapshot of what will be there as soon as they actually push the button and make it live, which I hope will be in the next week or so. So I've broken this down into five different modules, and per the title, it's something that's targeted at all developers. It's not an ASP.NET course or anything that sort of ties to one framework or technology. And I kicked off by going, here's the HTTPS value proposition. Like, here is why you want it. And I'm kind of hoping that this is useful not just for folks of you who might be watching this, or those of you who may be watching this, but you often have people that you need to influence within your places of work as well. So you got to convince the boss, why do we have to do this on, say, a site which is mostly for public consumption? So I talk about things like the New York Times has just gone HTTPS only. Why does the New York Times need to go HTTPS only? Well, glad you asked. It's in that module. So it sort of sets the scene there. Talks a lot about things like the growth of HTTPS. It's growing enormously quickly. And by growth, I mean the number of websites adopting it. So we're now seeing a significant portion of the Alexa top 1 million websites using it. My mate Scott Helm often does stats on these. Every 6 months he goes through, and he's finding sort of every 6 months that it's increasing like another 50%, which is a rate of growth which can't be maintained, obviously. But that's good, because we're getting to the point where there's a significant amount of stuff served securely. We also saw Mozilla reporting for the first time, I think it was about in October, that more than 50% of the requests they put through their browser was to a secure connection, which is good. Now, that's not 50% of websites. The Alexa top 1 million are around about 18% of websites. The tail after that, I would assume, is probably going to be less. But it's more than 50% of requests, because there are a lot of requests that go to Facebook, Twitter, Gmail, all this sort of stuff, which does security very well. So the growth is really well. Next module, I do HTTPS fundamentals. And this is understanding things like, what is SSL and TLS? And why do we keep saying SSL when we mean TLS? And does it really matter? No, it doesn't kind of really matter. It's just a name that's stuck. But I'll talk about that. Talk about things like the handshake, right? There's a negotiation phase when a connection is made. And it's actually kind of useful to understand that. Now, again, per the title, this is for developers. So I don't get into detail about things like cipher suites and how to configure your servers with certs and all that kind of stuff. Most organizations have IT pros or server admins or whatever you want to call them who does that for you. I'm really interested in talking to the devs that need to know how to configure their apps to work securely. But understanding things like negotiation is important, because that also explains where some of the latency comes in when you're actually making a secure connection. So that's that one. Also, I use badssl.com a bit. Now, if you haven't used this before, go and try and do this. Go to badssl.com. It'll test your TLS. So there's a hint. The badssl.com is really useful for looking at what happens when your HTTPS is implemented insufficiently. So that's module two. Module three, securing the app. So I talk a lot here about what do we actually have to do at the app level. And there is more to it than just whacking a cert on a server and going, that's it, job done. Because we've got to do things like make sure we don't have mixed content. Now, many of you probably know that already. Many of you would also know that many others do not know that. So we keep having these problems where we get warnings on pages about mixed content. Now, obviously we can fix that by embedding content securely. We can also fix it by using things like the upgrade insecure requests content security policy, which is really neat. A lot of people don't know you can do that, which saves you when you screw up and you don't embed things securely. Things like HSTS, many of you are probably familiar with HTTP strict transport security, really awesome way of making everything HTTPS all the time and solving some of the problems we have when people make insecure requests, which still happens very regularly. So they're really good. So that's, where was that? That's module 3. So that's kind of good. Things like, secure cookies as well. The number of times cookies just don't have a secure flag on them and they could be passed by an insecure request. Crazy. Now, one of the modules I really like on this, fourth module, overcoming the perceived barriers to adoption. Because people always have reasons why they can't do this, right? They go, we can't do HTTPS because it's going to slow stuff down. Well, not really, you know, and there's stats and figures and things. There's stats from the likes of Google, where when they went HTTPS only on Gmail, they reckon it cost them about 1%. In fact, I think they say less than 1% CPU overhead and a very small amount of network bandwidth. There are things like the ability to then use HTTP2, which can do binary streams of content as you load the page, which makes them super fast. People get very upset with me when I say that because I go, hey, look how fast HTTPS is. And they argue and they go, no, it's HTTP2. And then I go, yeah, but try and do HTTP2 over HTTP. Guess what? You can't because it's only supported over HTTPS for all the browsers. And we do this round and round and round thing. Point is that you can take the secure protocol and go much faster with that than what you can with the insecure protocol. So this is nice, right? Like perceived barriers. There are actually better ways of doing things that not only overcome the barrier, but make your site better than before you had HTTPS. I talk about Let's Encrypt, which is really good for some things, not as good for others. I talk about Cloudflare, which is really good for other things too. So all of that around barriers, you know, things like the price and the effort of config and everything, all that goes away when we have providers like those two guys. So that's really good. And then lastly, I go beyond the basics. And again, I wanted to keep this dev-centric. So I didn't want to delve too much into things like I mentioned just before, Cypher Suites or TLS versions or things like that. I do talk about SSL Labs, which you may have already seen, which is just a really good way of, I guess, having the penny drop of how much stuff goes into an HTTPS configuration. You know, so what versions of TLS are you supporting? Are you still supporting old Cypher Suites or old hashing algorithms, which might cause other problems? So that's a really good good resource there. I go through a bunch of TLS acronyms like DANE and CIA and DNSSEC and a whole bunch of other things just to go, look, here's what they are, worthwhile being aware of it. You may want to go and do more research later on, but let's just create some awareness. So anyway, that's the whole thing. Now, this actually has taken me about 3 months to do. And it's partly taken 3 months because I've been overseas. I've had about 4 weeks away during that period, which has been quite a bit. I've also wanted to see my family, which is kind of important. So it's taken a while to do it. And it's come out at about 3.5 hours. I hope Pluralsight will have that ready very soon. I'll certainly be shouting that from the rooftops when it's there. And I really hope I can get a heap of people watching that and trying to get that HTTPS adoption back up well above the percentages that it is now. It'll happen. I hope this course helps. All right, so that's that. That's good stuff. Now, something else. I wrote about loading 140 vBulletin databases into Have I Been Pwned. 140 in one go. Now, what actually happened here, this was in the news a while ago, is someone's gone around, they've owned a bunch of vBulletin, sucked all the data out. Inevitably, a lot of them have been unpatched, self-managed. Someone stood it up years ago, went, yeah, she'll be right, and they just left it. Someone's gone through and owned them, bundled it all up into one great big stash. Now, even then, it was only 943,000 accounts. Only 943,000 accounts. But I loaded it in one because it was getting press as one great big bundle of data. And it was also data breaches of a size that I couldn't justify independently loading. So every time I load a data breach, it's probably taking me between 1 and 2 hours, even for a little one, because I've got to verify it, I've got to go through and process it, I've got to write something about it, I've got to write a tweet, I've got to find a logo, I put the company logo on everyone. And then I've got to upload it and like orchestrating it all together. So this is why I'm pretty cautious about what I actually load, and I try to focus on the larger stuff. So that was sort of one great big stash. I wrote a blog post explaining what it was, listing each of the individual sites in there that was owned as well, and how big the file was and how many emails are in there. So you might find yourself in this one big data breach, and then you can go to my blog and you can see a list of the sites, and most people recognize where they've actually shared their data before. So that was a big one. I also loaded 4 other data breaches, and I want to point out an interesting pattern. By the way, when I loaded those 140 vBulletin sites, 55% of them were already in Have I Been Pwned. So 55% of the email addresses in there had already been in the system. So they've been breached somewhere else before. These people were all going, oh yeah, well, 55% of them were going, I've been here before. Now, other data breaches. I loaded 4 other ones. I loaded Soundwave, 130,000 accounts, 57% of them already in Have I Been Pwned. A site called Torrent Invites, kind of self-explanatory, it's a torrenting site, 352,000 accounts, 64% had already been in Have I Been Pwned. SWE Clockers, which is a Swedish technology site, 255,000 accounts, 66% of people in Have I Been Pwned. And finally, one called HLTV, 611,000 accounts, 57% had already been in Have I Been Pwned. You may see a pattern here, which is that every single one of these 5 data breaches I've loaded this week has had more than half of the accounts already appear in another data breach. And it's getting to the point now where every time I load a breach, it's like, well, I know that the majority of people in here are going to already be in Have I Been Pwned. And it is, you know, I see people on Twitter, they kind of make jokes and go, maybe you should just go, I'll let you know if you haven't been pwned, and then that will be a smaller number. And they're kind of right. I mean, the mechanics of it wouldn't quite be the same, but they're kind of right in that so frequently now we're seeing the vast majority of people in a data breach having already been in another one, which is kind of bad news for them, and it's frankly kind of bad news for the industry as well. But this is where we are. I thought that was an interesting fact. Now, speaking of data breaches, and I'm going to pull over something here so I can actually talk through this. I wrote a blog post yesterday, which had been in draft since October, somewhere thereabouts, and it's called Data Breach Disclosure 101, How to Succeed After You've Failed. And what I really wanted to write about here was, you know how a website gets hacked and then the owners of the website hopefully send out communications and they go, well, you know, this is what happened and this is what was impacted and this is what you should do. And we get these data breach notifications. And very often they're kind of terrible. You know, like we see these notifications and they often fall into one of multiple categories of how to do it wrong. And what I wanted to do was not just point at things that were done wrong and explain why this is problematic, but also point at ones that had been done very well. Because I've also seen some very good communication from data breaches. And the curious thing about this is that it's really no more work to communicate well than what it is to communicate poorly. But it does take a bit more forethought and it does take a bit of industry awareness. So I wanted to write this blog post, which seems to have gone down really well. I only posted it probably about 14, 15 hours ago, so early feedback. I wanted to write this as a bit of a guide. And I'll sort of talk about some of the things I've covered here. So, you know, one of them was make it easy to submit security reports. Now this, you sort of read this and you go, well, yeah, like, of course you'd do that. But honestly, it is so hard to submit ethically, responsibly to organizations, to the right people in organizations, that I just expect now, if I'm going to try and report something, I know it's going to be hard. Because it almost always is. And I give an example in here. I show Cloud Pets. Now, Cloud Pets, I spoke about at length in a previous update. It's just a debacle in every way. But, you know, they didn't reply to any emails. They weren't answering the phone. Plenty of other websites don't have any easy contact information. It can be difficult to find things like an email address. Whois is often unreliable because someone else registered the domain. If you find an address, finding one that actually goes to security people, because you don't really want to tell, say, the receptionist that you've had some, you know, major security incident. You want to get through to the right people. It can be really, really hard. Now, I've got an example in here where I show Tesla. And Tesla do an awesome job because they have got a security vulnerability reporting policy. Right? And in here, I point out a few things. I've got a policy. They've got an email address specifically for reporting vulnerabilities. They publish their PGP key. So obviously they're saying if you want to encrypt, you can do that. Plus, it's kind of a good idea if you're going to encrypt, because it might be something very sensitive. They also say, look, this is the stuff you shouldn't do. You shouldn't go and access customer data, right? So, you know, a bit of guidance as to how you should proceed with your testing. And they also say, look, we'll respond in 1 to 2 days, which seems kind of reasonable. Now, none of this is hard, right? This is text. Like, that is the extent of how difficult this is for an organization to do. Write text, put it on your page. I mean, sure, show it to the lawyers, all that sort of stuff, but ultimately it's a few paragraphs. Tesla also have a bug bounty. To me, that goes above and beyond sort of the bare minimum of what you need to do just to be able to get reports from people. Because if I go to a website and there's a specific area in there that says, here's how you submit vulnerabilities, I know from the outset that they've actually thought about this and they're going to take it seriously. So that was one of them. Now, treating security reports with urgency. This, again, is kind of one of those, well, yeah, of course, moments, right? Where you go, if someone's going to report an incident, we probably should look at it kind of quickly. So often, it doesn't happen. And I got an example in here of Triple O Web Host, who late in 2015, I tried so hard to get in touch with these guys. And I was in touch with like a help desk, and I'm going, this is really serious. Like, you want to get me through to the right people. Now, it was 13 million accounts of theirs, which were publicly exposed, including plain text passwords. Good on them for that. And I had so much trouble getting through to these guys. So that wasn't real good. That was a bad example. I've got a quote here from Cloud Pets. I've got an embedded tweet from a reporter. When one of the reporters I was working with tried to get in touch with Cloud Pets, they were quoted as saying, "We did have a reporter try to contact us multiple times last week. You don't respond to some random person about a data breach." Yes, you do, because it's random people that find these things and try to send them to you. Random people are one of the best assets you can have in terms of actually finding out about broken things in your website. So not so good there. That wasn't real good news at all. I also talk about Pay As You Gym, another website that got breached. I've got an example here of a guy. He looks like a bad guy because he's got a hat and goggles and that sort of stuff. I assume he's a bad guy. Tweeting Pay As You Gym going, I've got your data. You probably want to talk to me. And they just ignored him. And of course, subsequently, he dumped it all. Not good there. Another point I make here is that you must disclose these breaches. And I know that this is another moment where you go, well, of course you should. Who wouldn't do this? But multiple organizations who've been breached that I know of, and plenty more that I don't know of, I'm sure, have decided not to. So we've got lots of cases in here. I'll give you a good one here. Lifeboat. So Lifeboat do these Minecraft servers. They got owned early last year. They had about 7 million accounts owned. I reported it through a reporter for various reasons at the time. And when the reporter got comments from them, their words were, "When this happened in early January, we figured the best thing for our players was to quietly force a password reset without letting the hackers know they had limited time to act." And this is total bullshit, right? Like, this is saying, if we tell everyone that they've been owned, the hackers are going to try and hack you faster. And that was their excuse. Now, other than the fact this is also illegal, depending on your jurisdiction, not disclosing a data breach, it doesn't make any sense because as I show further down the screen here, what actually happens is that people who had been in the data breach are then going, well, hang on a moment, I use the same password on everything else. This person says, literally all my passwords, social media, personal servers, email, etc., were this password. Do I have to change them all? Well, yeah, you do. And guess what? Someone's been owning those accounts for the last 3 months because Lifeboat didn't tell you that you needed to change your password. So you've got to disclose this stuff. You've got to disclose it early as well. I talk in here about the likes of Michael Page, whose provider, Capgemini, lost rather a large amount of database backups. Well, they didn't really lose them. They sort of crowdsourced the backups because they put the backups on a publicly facing website and it was obtained by at least one other party. Don't know how many others. Anywho, so they took 11 days after finding out about it to disclose it. And I know it was 11 days because I told them when it was originally found. So I was the channel which they learned it from. And it was 11 days later that impacted people heard about it. It doesn't take 11 days to, first of all, figure out if it's legit. Second of all, figure out how many people are in there. And thirdly, send an email. 11 days is ridiculous. I talk a bit about GDPR in here. So GDPR being this regulation that's coming into Europe, it makes a lot of sense on a global level. And indeed, people globally will have to pay attention to it because they've got some various bits and pieces in there which impact EU citizens' data in other places. And they talk about 3 days. And 3 days, when you think about it, you go, yeah, 3 days is pretty reasonable. You know, like if we as an organization lose data, once we know about it, if we let people know within 3 days, that seems kind of fair. So anyway, that to me seems like a good time frame. So we go on, and again, there's other examples in there. Ethereum, they got breached, just their forum, not their actual blockchain stuff. So they had a data breach. They let people know very quickly. Good on them. Other issues with things like people, organizations, they get breached and then they go, so all your passwords are out there, you probably should change your password. Okay, no, you probably should force a password reset on everyone now, right? Like you shouldn't leave the system open and running there with passwords that you know that other people now have that could be used to compromise the accounts of your customers. Seems kind of obvious, but here we are. We get lots of sort of false or misleading statements as well in data breach notifications. So I've got a great example here from the Philippines. And look, there are times when statements are left open to interpretation. Where an organization says something and you go, well, they could have meant this or they could have meant that. But when the Philippines Election Commission said that contrary to many reports, the information set did not include voters' email addresses or the names of the voters' parents. Yet I have a 250,000 email addresses and I emailed a bunch of them and they said, yes, these are my parents, right? That's just an outright lie. That's not misdirection. Now, things operate a little bit differently in the Philippines to, let's say, Australia, UK, US. So I don't see them being held too much to account for that. But that is an outright lie. That's nasty business. Don't lie to your customers after you've already lost their data. So that's a problem there. Now, we see similar things as well, even in the UK. So PayAsYouGym, I mentioned before. They said, we do not hold any financial or credit card information. They said over and over again, we didn't lose your credit card information. And all the while, there's posts on like Reddit, which is like, here's all the credit card information. Okay, like, read the media and you'll see that, yes, you did lose the credit card information. Now, PayAsYouGym later had to come out and apologize and say, well, actually, we did lose your credit card information. And of course, that just made the thing even worse. So you see the point here, which is the way these organizations communicate is very important. Because if you get on top of it early and you're accurate, you can kind of stem the rage, right? You can put your story forward. You can make yourself, or rather present yourself, in a fairly positive light. When you take a long time and you're misleading and you look deceptive, it's just not a good thing at all. All right, not being vague was another important one. So I've got a data breach notification here from jobstreet.com. And I really don't understand what it means. Yeah, go and have a look at the blog post. It's just very, very unclear. So being explicit, and I've got actually a positive one from Soundwave here, positive insofar as they're clear, where they say, well, we put production data on a test database. We lost it. Your passwords were hashed with MD5. It's not pleasant having to tell someone that, but it is the right thing to tell them. So good on Soundwave for handling the situation in the right way once it had already happened, but probably don't do either of those two things ever, ever again. So there's that. And to that point, I then go on and say, look, you got to explain what actually happened. And I go back to Michael Page again and go, look, Michael Page is saying three countries lost data, yet here is a screen grab that's got about, geez, how many have we got in here? A couple of dozen different countries, such as Australia, which is one of the countries they didn't say lost data. We've got Australia sitting here with, how much do we have for Australia? 331 megabyte zip file. Now that, to me, like you'd look at that and go, well, Australia's lost 331 megabytes worth of zipped content. And they say they didn't. So explain it, you know, like give people information. Keeping people updated as well. So these incidents take a while to play out. Like the data breach happens and then there's going to be an investigation. It may involve law enforcement. There may be other things that have to happen and more things that are learned as you go along. Let people know. You can't do a Michael Page and wait a week and a half without saying anything. You've got to do something promptly, otherwise you have problems like Lifeboat. So you've got to do that. And then you've got to try and be nice and prompt and accurate and all the rest of it. And yeah, as part of that, it means letting people know as things progress that you're still there, you're dealing with it, here's the state of affairs. And the last thing in here, and this one is really hard, it's not really hard, is to apologize. Because regardless of how much of a malicious cyber actor was behind the original attack, and a lot of companies like to go, illegal access, unauthorized this, malicious, yada, state-sponsored, whatever, you know, and they're just sort of doing this whole sort of dog ate my homework kind of thing, which is deflecting blame. At the end of the day, you screwed something up in your system. Now, not only did you screw it up, but you didn't realize you screwed it up. Someone else found it. They exploited it. You lost the data. You got to apologize. You know, I mean, this is like I've got little kids. You're teaching this, right? You did something bad. You should say you're sorry. I've got a headline in here from the Red Cross Blood Service. So this is how they communicate on their website about their incident. And the headline is, Blood Service apologizes for donor data leak. And then we've got the CEO in there saying, I'm really sorry about this. And she handled it exceptionally well, where she said, look, it was actually a partner that lost the data, but we're going to own this. We're going to take responsibility. It's our issue. And that is just such a simple thing to do. And it starts to win back positive consumer sentiment. So have a read of that. That, I really hope, serves as a reference point for many years to come as to how people do data breach notifications. Last couple of things. This week I've got Exabeam sponsoring me. First time I've had Exabeam on, so big thanks to those guys. They do a bunch of stuff around logging, analysis, incident response. They're up there in the top banner of my website at the moment, so give them a click and show your support. And finally, next week I will not be here. I will be down in one of our southern states, actually. I've bought another car, and it is down many thousands of kilometers away, so I'm going to go and pick that up and go for a bit of a road trip. I've got some Microsofty things to do along the way, but I think I'll probably record next week's update in the car with a guest. And I won't say who it is, you'll work it out at the time. But someone else who might actually be able to contribute to this a bit. And that'll be a different scene. And frankly, it'll be about the only time I get to record as well. So thanks very much for watching this one. And I will see you from a very mobile location a week from now.